You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, September 8th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hi.
So we got to start. I got to tell you a story.
I love stories. I'm
already bored. Last night, my wife and I are watching TV before bed, so it's late at night. It's dark outside. And our dog, who you may or may not know, is named Sagan. He was named Sagan before we got him. We didn't name him that. But anyway, he is a good guard dog, so he'll typically bark if things are, you know, on the deck, right? So he starts barking. And every time it's raccoons, right? We have a family of raccoons that live near us, and they always come up to the deck to get the bird seed, right? The bird food. So he starts barking. I'm like, oh, the raccoons are back on the deck.
Mm-hmm.
So I go over there. It's like a sliding glass window onto the deck, and I can't see anything with the light off. So I turn the light on to scare the raccoons away, and there are not raccoons on my deck.
Oh, it must have been a cat or a...
was a black bear.
Ooh.
How big? When did this happen?
Last night.
How big was it?
Did you take a photo?
Well, hang on. So it was it was on the railing of the deck. Like, it was doing an acrobatic act on the railing of the deck. It was had almost gotten into our suet. Like, it bent the steel bar that it was hanging from. Thing must be strong.
Oh,
black
man.
Black bears are awesome.
Oh, geez. If that thing falls, Steve, it's gonna be bad.
Yeah, oh, he would die, I think, if it fell off that. Might have a high deck.
20 feet. That's a 20-foot drop.
That's crazy high.
Yeah.
Would it really die?
I don't know.
A 20-foot fall? I don't know.
But don't they climb trees? Fall. Do they fall out of trees?
I think they climb down.
Voluntarily.
So I took out my phone to take a picture, but by the time I got signed into my phone and blah, 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 opened up the camera thing, my dog had scared it away. So they're very, very skittish. You know, they're very timid creatures.
They're beautiful.
This was a beautiful, beautiful animal. I think it was like, either it was a young female, because it was on the smaller side for a black bear, or it was a yearling, but it was like perfect. You know, like there was no battle scars or anything. It was just a gorgeous animal. Yeah, so he sort of stared at me for a few seconds, and then he jumped down onto the deck, and my dog continued to bark, so he ran onto the stairs. Then he like turned around and was looking at us from the stairs, like, can I go back for the food? Are they going to go away?
It's like, well,
what's
maybe.
Going on? But then he ran off.
Made a risk benefit assessment. Ran.
All right. So listen, I looked up the statistics on black bears because there's been an increase in black bear sightings in Connecticut.
They're not dangerous.
They're not dangerous at all. There are no cases. There are no cases of black bears harming people in Connecticut. You know, at least anytime recently. I looked up the number of reported sightings per town. So there's actually only a few in Hamden where I live. There were five. You know, I reported number six, I guess.
Cool.
Bob, in Newtown where you live, 120.
120 what?
Black bear sightings this year.
But Steve,
one of the highest towns.
I've never seen one here, and I will never tell Mom that statistic.
Before you
ever.
Continue, though, that could be two bears with all those sightings.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, I know. It's sightings. It's not different bears necessarily.
Yeah, we got to tag these things.
But the number of sightings probably relates to the density of the bears, I would imagine. So it's more mainly in
the
Northwest.
Or the density of the people.
Yeah, could be. But
well,
you know, Hampton's a very populous town.
We're
surrounded by forest.
Yeah, Mom has just an unrealistic expectation of what danger she's in. I'm like, Ma, you're 83. Have you ever seen a bear in this entire area of Connecticut? Nope.
Wait, but black bears aren't dangerous.
They're just not dangerous. They're not aggressive to people at all.
Doesn't matter. She has a story. She has a story about her friend whose grandkid was mauled to death by a bear. And
but
that's
it's
all
probably
she
a grizzly
needs.
Bear.
Not in Connecticut.
In Connecticut.
Yeah,
gotcha.
It's probably not true. What are the chances?
Exactly. That's not a right memory. Right.
I searched for like, Mom, I could find nothing on the internet about that.
She's
that would be kind of big
bear.
News.
As long as you're not wearing your meat necklace, you're okay.
Right. So, of course, all the sites recommend taking down your bird feeders. Like, I'm not doing that. I'm not taking down all my bird feeders.
No way.
You know, this is the second time we saw a black bear on our deck a year ago, and now this year. So if once a year a bear comes onto my deck, who cares?
No, that's great. You're lucky.
Yeah, that's nothing. if they start making a regular thing is if they start regularly coming to whatever wherever the source of food is,
if you're on their route,
you definitely got to take it down. You got to do whatever you got to do, because if bears become habituated to that source of food, they'll lose their fear of people and of dogs. And then they could become more aggressive.
Well, and also they will destroy your property to get
they
to
food. Do, yeah.
Like they will rip stuff up.
They are
there.
Strong. They will do a lot of property.
They'll break
damage.
Into your car. Like bears are awesome. And they're smart. That's why when we camp in the Sierras here in California, there are bear boxes, which are these like lock boxes that you put your food in, where you have to put your hand up under like a hood in order to undo it, and bear paws can't fit in there because they're smart. They'll figure out how to get into anything.
Yeah, if you remember, we talked about the neuronal density item. Bears were up there.
Really?
Right? Bears had have a high neuronal density. They're very smart.
Yeah, they're smarter than the average bear.
Nice.
Hey, boo-boo. All right. Let's get to some corona news. So it was a good update.
Really?
Well, you know, this is what I predicted was should happen. I would have been horribly disappointed if this didn't happen.
Okay.
You remember we talked about oleandrin, the snake oil derived from that poisonous plant, the oleander plant.
Good for what else?
The MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell was trying to hawk.
So, snake oil.
Yeah, what I said was he started trying to simultaneously do two things. To get approval for oleandrin as a drug, and failing that, to market it as a supplement, which I loved the fact that he is exposing the scam that the current, you know, United States supplement regulations are.
Like inadvertently.
Oh, yeah, inadvertently. Oh, we'll market it as a drug or
as
a supplement.
It's not his purpose to take it down, right?
Yeah, it can't be both. It makes no sense of, you know, either way. So the FDA ruled on his petition. So this is the news. And the FDA said that cannot approve this as a drug because you don't have any actual data
to
show that it works. And then as a supplement, they said two things. They said, we can't approve it as a supplement because you're simultaneously trying to get it approved as a drug.
His plan backfired.
Awesome.
But they said also, number two, we have significant concerns about the safety data. Now, for a supplement, you only have to show that they're probably safe, right? You don't have to prove they're safe. You just have to show that they're generally considered to be safe. But they couldn't even meet that low standard because it's a freaking poisonous plant.
Right.
So they denied it on both counts. They would not approve it as a new drug, and they would not approve it as a supplement. We'll see what happens going forward from here, but it's dead for now, which is good because, again, it's just ridiculous. You know,
the chances this will be used as a rallying cry to get the rules and the laws updated and changed to something more reasonable concerning supplements?
Zero.
Now. Great.
He'll just jump on a new bandwagon, probably.
It's more likely that the supplement industry will use it as an excuse to try to weaken the laws. Look, we're keeping this from people. You know, it's not fair.
Did you guys see that? Okay, so there are 9 vaccine candidates right now in phase 3. One of them just had to be paused as of today.
Oh, bad results?
Yeah, because of an adverse reaction.
Uh-oh. What happened, you know?
No, we don't know yet, but we know it's an adverse reaction in a UK participant in the AstraZeneca trial.
Yeah.
So this is why we need full phase 3 trials. This is why you can't circumvent this process or
you can't rush
it. Cut them short. Yeah, because you got to know this kind of stuff and it takes time to figure it out.
Especially with this disease, because it is so, the immunity of it is so complicated. It is actually reasonable. It's plausible that a vaccine could provoke an immune reaction that is harmful. And so we absolutely need to study it. And animal data is great. It's necessary before you go to human data, but it's not enough. It doesn't replace human data.
Yeah, all of these 9 vaccines that are in phase 3 would have already had animal data. That's how they got here. So yeah, at this point, it's like 30,000 participants, not of this trial, but across... No, yeah, of this trial within the U.S. so far, And one adverse reaction thus far, maybe it's something where they can get past it. Maybe it's not. Depends on probably how serious it is and how related to the actual vaccine it is, or if it's just related to somebody's pre-existing, you know, sensitivity to something or an ingredient in the vaccine. There's so many questions and it's going to take time to figure that out.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the pandemic rages on. 27 million cases worldwide. 900,000 deaths. We're going to see a million deaths worldwide before too long. 187,000+ in the U.S. They're modeling like what's going to happen going forward, and the estimates for this is in the United States. The number of deaths by the end of the year, by January 1st, 2021, is anywhere from 250,000 to 600,000.
Oh my God.
But with like 300,000 to 400,000 being the likely range.
So we're like the worst in the world still, right? Like we're number one. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think India and Brazil are still really bad, depending on how you slice the numbers. I think India has more cases, but per population it might still be the US.
Like based on GDP, we're doing really poorly, like really, really poorly.
Absolutely. UK is having another spike. They're having to clamp down again. They're not doing well either.
Yeah.
If you look at just the worldwide, like daily new cases, it's still as high as it's been, right? It's still way up there.
Spain's in a bad way right now, like really scary in Spain. Yeah. It's.
We're not even seeing the beginning of the end. You know, we're still in the middle of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're in the middle of the first wave. You know, if you look at the worldwide data. Yeah. We're in the middle of the first wave, and we don't know if there's going to be a second wave. So obviously we're concerned about it's school time in the Northern Hemisphere. We're getting to cooler weather in the Northern Hemisphere. And we're getting to flu season in the Northern Hemisphere, which might give us a double whammy.
Right.
The range depends on how compliant people are with wearing masks, social distancing, and good hygiene, right? So those are the variables they plug in when they say, well, it could be as low as like 250,000, could be as much as 600,000. Right. That's all the variables are compliance, you know, public compliance of like not doing mass gatherings. And of course, there's lots of
enforcement and then. Compliance.
It's enforcement and compliance, absolutely.
And we've got to remember too, guys. It's only been 6 or 7 months, at least in like the rest of the world. It's been longer in Wuhan, you know, in Wuhan at like ground zero. But that seems like a long time. And yes, it is a long time. But for a global pandemic, we don't even know seasonality yet. We don't even know if this thing is going to come back with a vengeance at the same time next year, even worse if we don't have a vaccine by then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, vaccine's going to be critical, you know, to really tamping this down. There's no question. And, you know, as you were saying, it's still an unknown. Until we have one, we don't have one, you know?
Do you think that the social distancing and the mask wearing and the behavior of people generally is going to decrease flu risk? Or do you think that people are also... Do you think that'll be tempered by the fact that people are like freaked out to go to pharmacies and go into public and might not get their flu shots?
Yeah, so we know that from March, the pandemic basically shut the flu season down several weeks early. So if people do mask wearing and social distancing, then that will reduce the flu season. But you're right, if people don't get their flu shot, that will have the opposite effect. But if people do both, like if people are really compliant, everyone gets their flu shot, they get it super early as soon as it's available. Remember, it takes 2 weeks for the flu vaccine to take effect. And we continue to do all of our pandemic social distancing stuff. We should have a very mild flu season.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Steve, wouldn't it also be somewhat mild if people just do the mask and social distancing but even without getting vaccinated for the flu? It could still...
Oh, yeah, that'll help. I'm saying they're independent. Right? But if you do both, it'll be even better.
Sure.
Yeah,
it's all up to people's behavior. It's all up to people's behavior at this point.
Then we're screwed.
Yeah,
you just got to remember, we're still in the middle of this thing. This is not over yet. And, you know, again, you always have to wonder what, you know, 10 years from now, when we look back on this, you know, then we'll know, you know, what phase are we in? And it's like some people have emailed us and that they're listening to our shows from like February, where we're talking about the epidemic then in Wuhan. It wasn't a pandemic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with the hindsight, knowing where it is now, of course, at the time, we had no idea what we were in for. And it's kind of weird to listen back, you know, when we're like, hey, it's don't panic, but who knows? Just got to keep an eye on this. We don't know what's going to happen. And like, yes, we do. It's going
to
be
time
bad.
To panic.
Right. So we might, you know, a few years from now, we could look back and go, oh my God, we had no idea that we were in, we hadn't even begun yet or whatever. We don't know.
Ah,
or
maybe don't yeah, even.
The story is still being written.
Or maybe it just, you know, this is the final push and it goes away. You know,
it's it could the be either, final either end of the spectrum. Are you trying to get us sued?
Look, all I'm saying is this, Steve.
Yeah.
I want some positivity, all right? It's been a bad year. Lots of horrible things happen to a lot of people, and we need to spread some good stuff.
Jay, I think there's reason for hope. If we get a good vaccine anytime in the next 6 months, which is totally possible, and you can combine that with like therapeutics and hopefully people actually getting the vaccine, we could be in decent shape in a year. Really good shape in a year.
And here's like a silver lining. I don't know if I would call it a silver lining, but the death rate is not as bad as it used to be, right? Mm-hmm. Like comparatively. So we know that people are still getting sick from this, and we know that some people are still unfortunately dying from this, but we know how to treat it better now. And we know, like, at least here in the US, even though we have places that are surging, a lot of our infrastructure is not being taxed to the limit anymore. Hospitals right. have enough ventilators, they have enough beds in most places, and they know what to do way better than they did 6 months ago. Sure. So that's good, you know. Your mm-hmm. odds of surviving this thing are better than they were at the beginning.
Yeah, and also, you know, the bottom line is, if you haven't gotten it yet and you're healthy right now, then you're probably already doing what you need to do to stay healthy, right? You know, like we
just
know
keep
how
doing
to,
it.
Yeah,
yeah, but keep doing it. Don't get a false sense of security.
Right. That was my second point. Was you have control. I yeah. always remind myself, like, if I have to go to the store, like, what I do is going to matter right now, and I only need to do it for a little bit. You know what I mean? You're not. It's not like you're. Most of us yeah. are exposed all day long to people that might have COVID.
I am.
Yeah. Right. Well, I said yeah. most Healthcare of us. Workers I mean, are, you're, yeah. you're, you know, you are for sure, Steve. But we have more control than we had 6 months ago because we have knowledge. We know what to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's true. And yeah, we know and what
working.
Not to do.
And
we know
working.
What not to waste our yeah. time on and how not to like be consumed with the anxiety. You know, we know not to like bleach our groceries, and we
yeah,
know that this
exactly.
is like an airborne thing. So there's certain ways that you could potentially get it and other things are less risky. And I think that's knowledge in that case is power as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're learning more every day.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny to think. I remember thinking I was poo-pooing masks. This is really early on before yeah. we had really any indication. I remember thinking, they're wearing masks? Really? And now when I think back at how I thought, I was like, damn. That, you know, I was going by what the experts were saying at the time, but it just seems so silly now. And it seems so obvious. I mean, it's so obvious that it's mask and physical distancing. That's it. That's the two biggies right
and washing
there.
Your hands. Washing your hands. Yeah, the three biggies. You really got to wash your hands.
Yeah, but that's number three.
Yeah.
But
yes.
Yeah, that's number three.
It
and
important.
It's, you know, and it's more in the four position. It's not the two, the mask and the distance. Those are primo.
Those are the credit. That's 90% of it. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well, Jay.
Yeah.
Tell us how AI is going to save us from deep fakes.
Oh, boy. So a deep fake is an audio or video file that has been some way modified. There's something synthetic about it or fake. The software developers use machine learning and artificial intelligence. And for example, like a common one that's out there right now is there's a video of Barack Obama talking and saying some really weird stuff, right? And it's funny. So a voice impersonator can mimic Obama's voice. They use the video of the voice actor's face as that person is pretending to talk like Obama. And then they map the mouth and the head movements. And then when they combine that with the audio, they can actually make a pretty damn good fake version of Obama mouthing these words, and it really does look like him. It's remarkable how well that they can do this. They could fake just that voiceover. So another thing that they could do is they can map someone's face, you know, head movements and expressions, and digitally replace another person's face on top of their face, right? So a lot of phone apps already do this, right? You guys must have, like, done this with what's all the stuff that the young people use today, Steve? Guys, come on. I know. I'm too old for this. What do they use?
TikTok.
TikTok. Thanks.
MySpace.
I don't think TikTok does it. You know, it's
Snapchat.
Snapchat does it like crazy. That's right. So yeah. you could basically, you know, have your face be covered with a completely different face. You could have your head wearing some type of funny hat, or you have a mustache, whatever. What they're doing is they're mapping your face, and they know like where the corners of your mouth are. They know where your upper lip is, your lower lip. They know where your nose is, where your eyes are. And then they could pretty much, you know, resize the image and put it on top of your face. And it's kind of moving around as you move your head. This is on your phone today, right? So the high-end version of this, let me give you an example. I saw this amazing video of a Tom Cruise impersonator with Tom Cruise's face mapped onto his face. Now, the overall effect was really good. It was amazing. So behind the scenes, what they do is they take a video of the person that they want to mimic. So in this case, they found a video of Tom Cruise just sitting in front of a video camera talking. And I actually know exactly what video that they used because it was one that we covered a long time ago where he was like, it was like the leaked behind the scenes footage of him talking to people in the Church of Scientology. Anyway, perfect video. So what they do is the software analyzes the facial movements, the head movements, the expressions, and then the more video that they can analyze, the better the outcome. So the ideal situation would be that the person sitting in front of the camera is moving their head in every direction that they can and making every facial expression that they could possibly make, and then talking and watching how the mouth moves when they talk. And the software studies all of this, and it figures out basically the movement, the places that this person's face will move and the way this person's face will move, and they model it. And they make not only a visual model of it, but they make a movement model of it. So they know that when this person is, for example, says a word that has the letter O in it, what shape does their mouth take, right? It's every tiny little nuance that it saves. So then what happens is when the voice actor, the person who's actually playing Tom Cruise in this instance, when they talk, the software is able to detect their face, their facial movements, and map the other person's facial movements and face on top of it. So it is much more complicated than what I just described. But in essence, they're mapping your face, and they've already done this incredibly detailed mapping of the other person's face, and they're able to put one face on top of the other. And the result is really, really good. Actually, the thing that I thought was the easiest to do, they had a little trouble with, and that was matching the skin tone of, you know, the perimeter of the guy's head, which wasn't Tom Cruise's face. When they put the face on top of it, the color was a little off. And I'm like, God, of all the things, you'd figure that would be the easiest thing to match. You know, literally the way that when the guy opens his mouth, it looks like Tom Cruise's mouth. It looks exactly like the way he moves his lips. Really, it's just so unbelievable what it can do today. All right, so that's one type of deepfake. Here's another kind. This one is called a neural voice puppetry or audio-driven facial reenactment. This is when audio of someone talking can be mapped to any face desired and make it look like that person is saying the audio. So as an example, they can take me talking right now and map me just listening to what I'm saying. The software can analyze what I'm saying, and then you could just see it on 100 different faces as I'm talking in real time. It could just be moving the mouth of all of these other completely legitimate looking faces of famous people or whoever you would want to use. And the mouth movements and the head movements are mapped, and it looks really good. Like, it's actually odd how well it looks, and it's doing it in real time. That's scary. So another thing that they're working on is something called synthetic audio, where they use a neural network to take a very small sample of someone talking. So let's say that Steve talked for 5 or 10 seconds. It's incredible what it can do. What it does is it maps and figures out and reverse engineers the way that that person's voice sounds and any inflections that they have in their voice. This includes, you know, the timbre, intonation, minor inflections, and this enables someone to literally go from text to voice. So the computer listens to his voice. They do this whole analyzing of it, which I'm sure takes a long time to process. And then you have a situation where I could be typing into a computer and it can be talking in Steve's voice. And of course, that is the same. The longer of a sample that they have, the more accurate it can be. Of course, it could take, you know, a day on an average computer, maybe days on, you know, on an average computer just to chug through 30 minutes of a video just to get it to where it could do the fake. Now, from what I've read, it could take about 3 hours of the person who you're trying to fake. You need video of them talking and moving their head for about 3 hours to really get this thing fully tweaked so it can mimic all the movements. But again, you know, as processors get stronger and the software gets better, they're going to be able to do this in shorter amounts of time with higher accuracy. And it's going to get to the point where I won't be surprised if they could just do a complete, absolute synthetic everything. There is no, it's mimicking the voice completely and mimicking the face and the facial movements and the gestures and everything completely in real time. I'm sure that we're going to see that in the not too distant future. In the near future, it won't be that far in the future when the average person won't be able to detect a deep fake. And this is the turning point. This is going to be like when the internet came or when you got your first cell phone. Like, as soon as they're out, you're going to look back and not really remember what the world was like before we had deep fakes everywhere. We're just going to be silly with deep fakes. And when the average person can be fooled, man, this is dangerous, because you could have a world leader, a fake of a world leader, saying something that could be potentially very dangerous, start a war, start conflicts. You know, before the truth gets its shoes on, the deep fake is out there convincing people that something was said that wasn't said. That's scary. So we have to really be able to deal with deep fakes, and companies are starting to develop ways of handling it. So Microsoft, as an example, they recently announced that they've created two tools that can detect deep fakes. The first one is called Microsoft Video Authenticator, and its purpose is to analyze both still images and video, and it's looking for signs that the video was manipulated. And the second tool is built into Microsoft's cloud storage platform called Azure. I don't know if any of you guys have heard of this or use it, but it's essentially like Google Drive, but it's meant specifically for business. And what the platform is doing is it's automatically detecting modified or manipulated content of any kind, and then signals the user that they're watching either authentic or non-authentic video or audio. I could not find anything that benchmarked how well it works with today's best deepfake. But the fact is, you know, we're going to see these big platforms like Google Drive and Amazon's Web Services, AWS. These platforms are going to have deepfake detection cooked right into the platform, and it'll be doing it in real time. You know, you upload a video and then a warning will pop up. Hey, this has been altered. And here, you know, look at a video sample of what's, you know, what we detected in the video. It's probably going to be something along those lines.
Yeah, but Jay, I think that's okay maybe for the next couple years. And even from what I've read about those, they're only like 66% accurate on good deepfake videos that they've never seen before. So even that's not that great. But the deepfakes aren't that awesome yet either. I think what we need to be doing, instead of just focusing on, let's detect these, let's work on software to detect them, which we should do, but we also need to prepare for when the time comes that we can't,
right,
we cannot detect the fake. What do we do? How do you combat that? Anticipate what's going to happen. That's what we really need to be talking about now. That's got to be a huge part of this discussion.
Well, here's the only one that I found, Bob. It's called blockchain, right? This is what some cryptocurrencies use to make sure that you can't hack in and create your own Bitcoin, for example. So blockchain is essentially, what you call it, Bob, peer-to-peer encryption. Like, it's encryption that happens that you absolutely can't crack it, and you have to have the key to unencrypt it. So it's very, very secure. You know, if you're using like a situation like this where you have a video that's being captured by a trusted source, right? And they're recording the video, they're broadcasting the video, they'll send the blockchain encryption along with the video. So on the other end, they'll receive that encryption. And if you have the key to unlock the encryption, then you'll know that you can authenticate that it's real, that it's legitimate, that it is coming from the source that is claiming to send it to you. And then you'll know that video is legit, right? You guys, did I explain that well enough? So if we do use the blockchain model, I think it would work, but I just don't know how ubiquitous it could be in the short term. Like, am I going to be able to send, you know, anybody that I want on social media something that's been encrypted that can be verified? Or at least you could say, this person shot this video, right?
Right.
But social media, man, that's where the tires hit the pavement. That's where people are consuming most of their news, most of their information. And how are they going to stop people from uploading deepfakes? Is Facebook going to have deepfake detection on the fly? Can it do it fast? Can it detect deepfakes fast enough to stop it before it does the damage that it's going to do? I don't know, man. This is a miasma.
Also, is it not the same technology that would be used for like making memes and for like doing stuff for fun? And at a certain point, is that really fair? Yeah, like, to block something. Like, mm-hmm. It's a context thing. Like, of course, this used to trick people, or was this like a fun, you know, viral video that's been going around of like a watermelon dancing?
That's fine. But I mean, this is when the devil's in the details. Like, you could say, use deep fake. You want to make fun of like whatever, your brother, an actor or whatever. But if you can't make a deep fake of anybody that's in any government, you can't make a deep fake of anybody that has any position of power. If you do it, you're breaking the law. That
what if it's an
stuff.
Obvious parody?
Now, if it's a parody that people are misconstruing as reality, then now you're blurring the lines, right?
Problem, isn't it?
It's like, going to be crazy.
Yeah. Well, why can't you just have to be forced to put a label on it, like this is a deep fake parody?
Yeah. Right, kind of like The Onion. Like
a watermark. But yeah, but I think there should be harsh ramifications. If you weaponize a deep fake, I think you should like go to jail.
Right, exactly.
I mean,
Bob,
they got to nail you hard and fast.
Yeah.
Due process and all.
Right.
But I think at least make some people think twice.
Right, because it's like libel, but like worse.
So just, this is one of those things as a critical thinker, as a skeptic, keep this in, somewhat in your conscious mind, and keep an ear out for it, because it's gonna pop soon. It's gonna be one of those things we're all gonna face soon. One day there'll be a video that people are like, "Oh my God, did you see that?" And then we'll find out it was faked.
Ugh, gosh.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I think that the bottom line is that there needs to be regulation to keep any of this technology from being used to deliberately deceive. Right, if it's to entertain or for satire or whatever,
that's
fine.
Not fraud.
But if it's done to deliberately deceive, mm-hmm. then that should be illegal.
That's a crime.
Yeah, that should be a crime. Right. Yeah, and the cohesion of our civilization depends upon getting this under control to some extent. You're obviously never going to eradicate it. It's going to be a part of life. It's going to do damage, but we got to figure out ways of minimizing it to the point where it's more of a nuisance than a game changer for society. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like when the printing press first came to be, like we had to come up with libel laws.
Yeah.
Right.
It's doing damage right now, guys. I mean, women are having their likenesses deep faked on porn sites every day. You know, they're experiencing the brunt of this before really anybody else.
I wonder if they have, do they have recourse?
I don't think
so,
no.
All right, let's move on. So let me ask you guys a question. Not you, Kara, because I know you read the article. What do you think is the cause of stuttering? If you had to guess, like what, from a medical, perspective, what's the...
I think it has something to do with what you hear. There's a delay in what you're
syncing
hearing.
Syncing up, yeah. Because I know that if you, with people who stutter, many of them experience like a dramatic attenuation of the effect if they block their hearing, if they can't really hear themselves, but that's all I got.
So, yeah, you guys are actually pretty close. So, historically, we had no idea, right? So the usual things that people said before we had any sense of how the brain works, like maybe it's the way they were brought up, or, it's a physical problem with them speaking. But as, neuroscientists have explored with the, modern tools, what's happening in the brains of people who are stuttering, they're finding that at least for, it's obviously in different people, it's different. Not everybody has the exact same cause. But I think at its core, it seems to be due to a sluggish communication of different parts of the brain. Right. So the brain's not communicating with itself as robustly as is typical. And speech is kind of the canary in the coal mine there, in that it's the one function that really requires, robust real-time communication in order to function optimally. And so you won't really necessarily notice a slight delay in other things that you do, but you do notice it in speech. And what parts of the brain are communicating in speech that is causing the stuttering? And it is the hearing part of the brain and the language part of the brain. So it's not just this disconnect, in terms of synchronization between what they hear and what they're saying. It's also them hearing themselves, right? But it may be more than that as well. It may be more than just, hearing yourself speak. It is partly how you process speech as well. So there's a few different things going on. One is the robustness of interneuronal connections, right? How how much is the brain talking with itself. There also seems to be a role played in some people who stutter with dopamine, that it's actually increased dopamine activity. But that increased dopamine activity may actually be contributing to the decrease in neuronal connectivity.
Oh, okay. So it's not just, is it just in the motor speech area where they're seeing more dopamine?
No, no.
Oh, interesting.
It is
okay.
More global. And then also in terms of anatomically, other studies have found that there is decreased astrocyte population in the corpus callosum. Now, the corpus callosum is the main cable between the two hemispheres, right? So it's the main pathway by which any network across the two hemispheres will be connected. And astrocytes are the cells in the brain that are not the neurons, right? They're not the signal carriers, but they're the support cells. But they're really critical for the function of neurons. They actually could modulate neuronal function, but they also keep them functioning optimally. So having a paucity of astrocytes in the corpus callosum could correlate with a sluggish communication across hemispheres, right? Because that, you know, the functioning of the connections in the corpus callosum might not be optimal because the astrocytes aren't there, but to biologically, you know, optimize the functioning. The third sort of piece to the puzzle here is genetics. So there's been a number of genetic studies. There are definitely families of people who, like, most of the members of the family stutter. So, like, really strong genetic component. And then others, there may be, a weaker genetic predisposition. But scientists have discovered a number of genes, you know, five in particular, that correlate with an increased risk of stuttering. But it wasn't really immediately apparent what connection these genes have to brain function, right? They wouldn't necessarily affect anatomy. What they did all link to, however, are the components that of the lysosome, right? So lysosomes are like the garbage cleaners of the cells. So they help the cells sort of get rid of bad proteins, proteins that are either, you know, were made wrong or are degrading. The decreased lysosomal efficiency that could occur from one or more of these mutations can affect the function of neurons in terms of the speed of their processing, right? So again, that can correlate back to the brain's not talking to itself in real time. So they tested this in a mouse model where they actually, you know, you could do a knockout where you breed mice that don't have the gene that you want to see what the gene does, you know, so they're not making the protein. And they found that, yep, it definitely decreased their neuronal activity. And mice apparently are quite chatty, mm-hmm. but they mostly talk to each other in ultrasonic frequencies that humans can't hear.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. So they're cool. Chatting away and we can't hear.
Oh, yeah. When you hear mice, like a baby mice squeak, what you hear is the lowest... frequency that it emits. All the other stuff is like way too high for us to even hear.
That's cool.
So in this one study, at least, the knockout mice for one of these genes linked to stuttering, the mice, you know, they were squeaking in a disjointed, stuttering way. They actually started stuttering in, you know, the equivalent of that in mice. So of course it's hard to make that correlation with humans, but you know that's how the researchers interpreted it. And then to complete this, so if increased dopamine activity, it might be playing a role. So there's a researcher who said, well, let's give people dopamine blocking medications and see if that helps their stuttering. And in fact, we already have dopamine blocking medications. They're called antipsychotic medications. So there's been several studies using off-the-shelf antipsychotics, and they do seem to work, but not completely. They have a modest effect. And but
they gotta rename those antipsychotics.
Well, that's the primary indication.
Yeah. And I mean, they have some pretty severe side effects too.
They have a lot of side effects. So they're trying to develop a dopamine antagonist that's anti D1 receptor, which is not an antipsychotic, but might be more specific for the stuttering with fewer side effects. So that's in development right now, and it's been tested, you know, preliminarily, but needs further research, you know, to fully develop that. So, yeah, that's a pretty quick summary of where we are with it. And it's interesting that, you know, the core is that it's a brain problem, first of all, right? It's not socialization. It's not learning. It's not how you were brought up or anything. It's a brain problem. And the brain itself is stuttering because of the different parts of the brain that have to like synchronously communicate with each other. It's being slowed down. Sometimes another part of the brain intrudes, and that's the problem. In some patients, some people who have stuttering, it's that there's this other part of the brain that's getting involved with the circuit, and it's basically interfering with, you know, the language circuit. But in other people, it's just that the primary circuit itself is just not fast enough to keep up in real time, and so it starts to stutter. Very interesting. So this, you know, I think plausibly, it's already led to some preliminarily effective pharmacological approaches, but they're also working on brain stimulators, you know, that to stimulate the parts of the brain that are not working as well. And that's showing some promising results in preliminary studies as well. Like if you do it during speech therapy,
yeah,
does it help them? But 80% of children who stutter outgrow it, their brain increases its activity over time. 20% just don't. They just don't improve. And their brains don't, you know, increase their activity. So it correlates pretty well. So hopefully in 5-10 years, you know, I know we throw that term around, but it does seem like the rate of progress has been pretty steep in recent years. And, you know, I do hope this is the kind of thing like in my career that we'll see some really effective treatments for it.
But the cool thing is, obviously, behavioral treatments work for some people because there are plenty of people who live, you know, normal, healthy lives and who have managed to get their stutter at least under functional control just through behavioral approaches.
Yeah, but the question is always, was it really the therapy or did they just outgrow it? Was it just regular brain development? Or how much of a combination is it? Like, we don't know. What's the percentage breakdown? Because again, 80% of people outgrow it.
Right. But aren't there some people who like have a stutter all the time, but then they're able to do public speaking and stuff because they utilize, you know, like CBT stuff.
Yeah. So those are techniques. So there are techniques that allow you to compensate for the stuttering. So that's different than fixing the stuttering.
Isn't that kind of what Biden is like? Like, because he has a stutter, right?
He has a stutter,
So he just has to work really hard while he's doing public speaking.
Yeah, I don't know how much he's outgrown it versus he's using a technique. Technique might be something, so you're basically trying to prevent the interference that might be happening, or you're trying to distract whatever, you know, yourself in such a way that you're preventing that desynchronization from causing the stutter. And they work, but they take a lot of effort.
Absolutely. But
you might get good at that. You might get good at it, so it takes less effort, but that's a compensated stutter versus a cured stutter, right? That's two different things. So yeah, stuttering is a phenomenon. It's not one thing. It's multiple different things, and different people stutter for different reasons. But I think they're zeroing in on the core phenomenon, at the root of many people who stutter, and so yeah, hopefully this will inform treatments going forward to the point that we'll whack it back significantly. All right. Let's move on. Kara, this is a really cool one you're going to tell us about.
Yeah.
Tell about people who are afraid of the undead.
Yes. And
it's not as cool as mine.
I don't know, Bob. I think you're going to like this one has vampires. This one has so much cool stuff. There's a study that was just published in PLOS One, the Public Library of Science One, which is an open access journal. So anybody can read the full text of this. Called Between Belief and Fear, Reinterpreting Prone Burials During the Middle Ages and Early Modern Period in German-Speaking Europe. Okay, so that doesn't really tell you what it's about, except that these researchers were like, how come some people are buried face down? What does that mean? What does the literature say? And why is it that we're seeing the patterns that we're seeing in the archaeological sites that we're looking at? So the lead author, who is a PhD student in anthropology, physical anthropology, she's studying in Germany. She realized she was looking at a burial site and was like, hey, this is weird. This body is face down. Bodies don't get buried face down. What is this about? And she decided to learn more. And it uncovered this whole interesting medieval history and all of these really interesting, I don't know if we should call them hypotheses, I think that's probably still a good word for it. I don't think we're in the theory place quite yet, but all of these hypotheses about the burial sites that she and her colleagues studied, and they came up with some kind of interesting ideas. But let's talk about what they actually found. They looked in German-speaking areas in the early to late Middle Ages. And so they found burial sites all over Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, because they realized that a lot of these prone burial sites had been studied in depth in England and other parts of the UK. They also realized that the literature was rich with prone burials in Eastern Europe, so in kind of like more Slavic regions, but they noticed that there wasn't a lot of good data in this Germanic area. Why do you guys think that people during the Middle Ages were buried face down from time to time?
They're afraid they were going to reanimate, so if they dig down, they can't hurt anybody rather than
right.
dig up.
So they wouldn't be able to dig up. Okay, so reanimation, revenants, vampires, things like that. But there are some other reasons that are pretty well documented. Can you think of any other ones?
Where they, you know, had problems in life or were criminals or something that, you know, is a form of punishment in the afterlife.
Right. Like a way to kind of mark them as aberrant. And then also one of the well documented reasons that people were buried face down was for penance. So sometimes
sinners.
People, and yeah, and this was actually, it's all kind of based on one well-documented example, which is Charlemagne's father, Pepin the Short, in 768 AD, who asked to be buried face down as penance for his father's sins. So this is a well-documented thing. There's a lot of provenance around that. And you will find sometimes that people will be buried face down in very prominent areas of sanctified land. So in a burial ground that's at a church in a very prominent area that is, you know, usually only used for nobles or important people, you will sometimes find people buried face down. And so that could be because they were paying a penance or because there was some sort of important reason to put this person facing basically what we would consider, quote, deviantly or the wrong way. There's a whole thing at the beginning of this article about the word deviant and how it usually has negative connotations, but it's really commonly used in this type of literature. It doesn't necessarily mean bad. It just means different from the norm. So these are deviant burials. Other types of deviant burials would be like facing, I think, east instead of west, or in a north or south orientation. That's not common. Their standard burial is west-east during Christian burials for some reason. Not for some reason. It's so they could like see Jesus, I think. Other things would be like being buried with stuff. This is kind of interesting. A super long time ago, people were buried with crap all the time. And then in more recent years, people get buried with crap. But there was a region during the early Middle Ages where people didn't get buried with crap. Like you just didn't find stuff in their graves very commonly. And they started to realize that there was a lot of variables. They looked at tons of variables in this study. So there are these great tables that you can dig in yourself where they look at every single specimen and they say, was it male? Was it female? Was it, you know, which, what was its orientation? Was it face up or face down? Was it decapitated? Were there nails?
Right.
Did it have, you know, tool marks? Was it wearing clothes? Was there crap in the grave with them? Were they in a shroud or a coffin? And then they did some really fancy statistics to see what kinds of things clustered together. And they realized that as the Middle Ages got from early to high, then to late, so once you started to see late Middle Ages, you started to see some certain things showing up, like coffins, whereas previously people were buried in shrouds. You started to see crap like coins and jewelry showing up on the bodies. You started to see these prone bodies also buried in the outskirts of cemeteries. And they started to realize, okay, so these seem to be perhaps correlating together and also correlating with something that was happening at a very particular time in European history in the high to late Middle Ages. What would that be?
The Black Plague.
Yes. And not just the Black Plague, but after that, there were a lot of plagues that were going through, and they could time them right to the year. And so whether it be the Black Plague, whether it be, you know, an outbreak of cholera, an outbreak of syphilis, they thought, well, maybe these plague bodies were being buried face down. And part of the reason that their jewels and things weren't taken from them is because people were scared to touch the bodies.
Yeah.
Oh, also, a safety deposit box.
Exactly. Like, I don't want to go through this decaying, you know, plague body.
You grab it, Charlie.
Exactly. Because usually either the family members would take those things back or the grave diggers would steal them. That was very common.
Right. Grave robbers.
Yeah, exactly. But just the people who were tasked with burying the guys would be like, I guess that was their tip. But right.
The old saying was, don't die with your jewelry on.
Exactly.
I got a new theory.
What?
And I'm going to coin a word here, potentially. Sloppy gravesmanship.
Right. So they actually talk about sloppy gravesmanship.
Wait, did they use that word?
No. They talked about, disheveled and disorganized funerary practice.
Yeah, like you had a shrouded body, you're putting it in the big hole, and he spins around. Like, okay, we'll leave him there. Or the coffin spins. just leave it. Who's going to notice?
And from what there are a lot of variables here, so I'm hope that I'm not crossing any of my threads. But from what I think I remember reading in the full text was that you do tend to see more prone burials as opposed to supine face up, prone burials towards outskirts and in poorer situations. So I think they take more care with burying the body anyway when the body is in a prime location within a Christian site, if that makes sense. Like, yeah, this is an important person. We're going to take care when we bury them. So there is a little bit of variance there that actually makes these hypotheses questionable. But the authors, if you read coverage on this, it's like the authors are saying that these were vampires. if you actually read the article, they say nothing of the kind. What they say is that there's a lot of Slavic literature from around the same time when people were buried prone, that there was a lot of folklore around vampirism. And mm-hmm. so there does seem to be a correlation between burying somebody face down and preventing them from becoming a revenant. In Germanic cultures, they didn't really have vampires. Their version of revenants are called Wiedergänger. And so these are individuals who would come back to the world of the living to avenge something, or because they're sort of in purgatory and they need to fix something before their soul could be released. And then they also have something called Nachseher, and that is a deceased person which stays in their grave and harms the living from the grave. So they will drain vital forces from their relatives. And Nachseher actually speaks to this idea of death devourers. I think that's where the word comes from. And that they would eat their own funeral shrouds and they would also eat their own bodies. And they
get hungry down there.
Right. So the researchers think that there's actually a pretty plausible link here between the folklore of Nachseher, burying bodies face down, and plague bodies, because at the height of plagues, there were so many bodies piling up that they would start to decompose in place before they could properly be buried. And when bodies decompose, they make noises. They make smacking noises. Gases get released. And
putrefaction.
You think back to before we had germ theory, when people thought that there was bad air, they were getting sick from miasma, or worse, this was a punishment from God. And now there's a dead body and it's making smacking noises. It's eating itself, you know?
Splitting.
We better bury this and make sure it doesn't get us. And so that's kind of what these researchers are saying could be an explanation for an increase in prone burials in the outskirts of cemeteries in high to late medieval Germanic regions. So it's sort of like not quite a vampire thing, but it's reminiscent of vampiric stuff from earlier Serbia, Romania, Lithuania, those regions. It speaks more to Nachseher and Wiedergänger. And also, they do talk quite a bit about the idea that there was an idea that this was sort of a curse that would happen when the first person within the household or within the village came down with the plague. Because again, think back to not having germ theory of disease. Someone gets sick. Who are the next people to get sick?
The relatives.
Yeah, their families.
Their families. The people they know. right? So if they're cursed, then all the people near them are getting cursed, and then the people near them are getting cursed, and it's passing along.
Oh my
gosh!
So would the families like try to cut it off, stem it where it was happening, and like attack their own relatives?
No, I think the idea is that if somebody died first, they would be buried face down to try to stem it.
I see.
So you didn't see that all the plague victims were buried face down, but that you might early on in the plague bury victims face down to try and stem that curse from making its way to the living. And that's what speaks to that, again, Nachseher, this idea that they're in the grave casting this damnation on living people. So if we can stem that by putting them face down, their souls won't be able to leave and go wander, the Widergänger, and also they're going to be trapped and be unable to actually kind of send their curses up, because they're just going to send them deeper into the ground. So again, a lot of this is hypothesizing, but it is actually based on some decent evidence, because they're comparing the anthropologic record to the social, cultural, and the literary record.
Yeah, is there any written record of these kinds of things happening? It must be.
Right. It's just, it's complicated. Like some of these, a lot of these burial sites from the Middle Ages are not well kept. And so they went to places where the provenance was as good as it could be. But a lot of times, you know, all they have is a death record. And especially during the plague, you would see mass burials, or you would see sometimes that multiple bodies were buried together. Some of the times when it might be a little more obvious that this could be a fear of a revenant or a punishment for like earthly wrong, are the times when they actually would find nails in the grave, so they would be nailed down, or the times when they would actually decapitate the body when it was
buried.
Heard
of the decapitation.
Yeah. But so I had never heard of this idea of like face down burial. And then also there are some pictures of the bones so that you can see what these face down burials actually look like when they're excavated.
You got it, Jay?
I mean, it's like you can't even, the word can't go by without laughing.
Nope.
What word? The bones?
Look at the bones.
Look at the bones.
Oh, no. I don't know what that's from.
Oh, Monty Python, the Holy Grail.
Oh, shit.
Oh, my gosh.
I know, and
so
I've seen it like 10 times. How could I not? And so taking all of this evidence and trying to put it together in a sophisticated statistical way, and of course they couldn't do that. They just had to take a portion of it and make sense of it. I don't know. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating window, you know, into that time period and the you know, belief systems.
And the response to pandemics, right? Like, can you imagine if we had those kinds of beliefs now? Oh, gosh, dealing with this. I'm so glad we have modern medicine.
Yeah, even thinking about, like, the 1918 pandemic, like, just trying to get survive that.
And we were, like, we were pretty good. We just weren't, we hadn't really caught on to the virus thing that well. We were, like, stuck on it being bacterial.
All right, thanks, Kara.
Yep.
All right. Bob, this is kind of a follow-up item for you, right? About muscular mice in space.
So, yes, researchers have created Mighty Mice, of course, the perfect name, Mighty Mice, with much more muscle than usual, and showed that these benefits don't go away in the microgravity of space. A potential boon for future astronauts, taikonauts, cosmonauts, and other potential future knots. Not to mention a boon for people that are experiencing the ravages caused by muscle-wasting diseases, which, of course, would be amazing. So this is from a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, led by Dr. Se-Jin Lee of the Jackson Laboratory in Connecticut, and co-investigator and spouse, Emily Germain Lee. Dr. Se-Jin Lee discovered myostatin, the myostatin gene, in 1997. He was the first person to show how the gene does what it does by regulating muscle growth. So myostatin is a protein slash hormone, and it's part of the many checks and balances that that keeps our bodies alive and does important things. This one specific one limits muscle growth in people and many species. When those breaks are removed, then technical term coming, hulking out happens. Muscle growth just gets into high gear. And these mice, I believe, had twice the muscle mass of regular mice. But I've seen pictures of like dogs, like a whippet with this natural condition. Where,
oh yeah,
like,
the hokey whippet.
Yeah, the whippet steer, like a steer, which was so huge and diesel that it's shocking to see so much muscle on a quadruped. It was just amazing. Now, so this effect, it has been proven in experiments. It's amazing, but it's really old news. I mean, I've read about this probably in the late 90s, and it's a thing. They could induce it. So what's new about it? And I guess the answer is mighty mice in space. So what they wanted to do was they wanted to answer the following questions. What happens to these mice in microgravity? And could an inhibitor of myostatin function help even normal wild-type mice retain their muscle mass in space? Now, you know what microgravity does to people. It's horrible. Your body is just like, well, there's no stress going on here musculoskeletal-wise, so you're not going to need, you know, this calcium in your bones. And yeah, you don't need all your muscle. So you could lose 18, 20% of your muscle, of your lean body mass. And that is horrible. So they've got to train. They've got to train every day for hours a day. And they're barely keeping pace. I think, if you went to Mars, from what I've read, you cannot maintain your muscle using modern methods like this, like working out. You will lose muscle. You will lose lean tissue. And by the time you get to Mars, I think you'll be very happy that the gravity was less than on Earth. But if you ever came back to Earth, you'll be hurting. So last December 2019, they launched 40 female mice, launched on the SpaceX-19 mission, and returned January 7th, 2020. And they had different types of mice. They had normal control mice. They had knockout mice. Steve mentioned knockout earlier this episode. So these mice lack a functional MSTN gene that makes them, these are the mighty mice. And you could do that. I mean, you could just breed it out. You could just knock it out and they're just born that way. And that's a great way to do experiments on animals, because you could see, all right, let's see what happens without this gene. And then the third type of mice that they had were mice that were given doses of a specific compound. These were regular mice. They gave them a shot of a compound known as Compound V. Oh, wait, no, not Compound V. It's called much less interesting, ACVR2BFC. That's the compound, not Compound V. That's for the boys.
Yeah, I don't. Okay.
I remember Compound W.
So similar mice, they had a group of similar mice on the Earth, and these are the mice that drew the small mouse straws. They stayed on the ground, looking up at the stars at night with tears in their eyes.
Aww.
Of course, the mighty mice on the ground cried a little less because, you know.
But we can't hear them because we don't hear that frequency.
Right. So what did they find? They came back. They parachuted into the ocean, and they were probably promptly slaughtered and examined. And this is what they found out: the wild mice from the ISS space station lost between 8 to 18% of weight in individual muscles compared to those on the Earth. So you had these are the controls. The ones on Earth were fine because they weren't in microgravity. The ones on the space station for a month lost 8 to 18% of lean tissue, and they lost up to 11% of bone mineral density as well. The mighty mice came back. They essentially maintained their muscles and were very similar to their counterparts on Earth. That's how they put it. They were very similar. Any differences, I guess, weren't even worth mentioning. So that's amazing. You've got these mice with twice the muscle. They go into a microgravity scenario environment for 30-something days, and they do not lose any muscle or bone mineralization. That's incredible. But even better than that, the mice that were administered the compound, Compound V or the ACVR2BFC, on the ISS itself, they gained more lean. This is how they put it in some of the articles that I read. They gained more lean body weight, 27%, than the group on the ground, 18%, including increased muscle mass, although they didn't gain as much muscle weight as the mice on the ground. So it's kind of a sentence you got to slog through multiple times to kind of get a handle on what they're saying. So they gained lean tissue, but they didn't gain quite as much mass as the mice on the ground that got the injection. What I love about this is that, I mean, this is the type of thing that you don't need to be born this way. They could, I mean, these are mice that are normal mice. They give the injection. It's an inhibitor. It inhibits the gene, and their muscle growth really kind of really goes doubles their muscle mass, or in a month they gained 27%. So that's huge. That's really huge for people who could need the increased muscle mass. Say if they're bedridden or suffering from a disease. So what can we expect in the future? Germaine Lee said that we're years away, but that's how everything is when you go from mouse to human studies. So of course, and this is just because it works in mice doesn't mean it's going to work like this for people. And a lot of times it just doesn't work. It translates so poorly that it's just not even ever going to work. So we've got to face that is a possibility. Although, I mean, we've seen this effect in so many animals, including humans. There are humans that are basically knockout humans where this gene, it is not functioning. And I've seen pictures of kids that have this, and they're packing some decent muscle, especially for like a 5-year-old. I mean, you could see that. Like, wow, that calf is pretty big. So obviously, if you know me at all, I think this is worth every dollar. The return on investment could be extraordinary. So here's a quote from Zhejin Li again. He says, "The knowledge we gain about microgravity's effects on muscles and bones will help us to enhance the health of astronauts both in space and on Earth, and also better understand the promise that myostatin inhibitors hold for the elderly, people who are bedridden, and for people experiencing muscle wasting related diseases like AIDS, ALS, cancer, and so many others." So obviously, this is a huge potential for these people. And for this alone, I think it's not even just the astronauts, but these people that are experiencing this muscle wasting disease. It could be an extraordinary help to them.
All right. So we started the news segment talking about fake deep fakes. But Evan, you're going to finish off telling us about fake reviews.
Yeah, fake reviews. Oh, yeah. Specifically Amazon.
They piss me off.
Oh, gosh. And they should, Bob. Now, have you ever shopped at the Amazon website looking for something you're unfamiliar with that you never bought before and relied upon the Amazon reviews and ratings of that product?
Yeah, yeah.
I have. Yeah. I definitely
all
have.
All the time, man.
Even more so, you might have used the ratings and reviews to not purchase a product. Had too many ones and 2 stars out of 5 ratings, yeah, and some pretty lousy reviews.
If I read even a couple bad reviews, I'm like, I'm not getting it. Even if it's only a small percentage, it's just like I'm really influenced by a terrible review.
I always look at the bad reviews. Yeah, just look at the good ones.
That's right. That's right. But you see, this is where our skepticism is supposed to come into play. But it sort of, in a way, defeats the purpose of Amazon. You know, Amazon is this place where you can go and sort of quickly run through the store, in a sense. It's supposed to be faster, more efficient, time-saving, all that stuff. I mean, who has time to figure out the reviews and ratings for a dish sponge or a sun hat, or in Bob's case, a 12-foot-tall plastic skeleton? Who's going to read that, except Bob?
Except Bob. Totally read those reviews.
Amazon listings, these products often have hundreds or thousands of reviews, instead of, by comparison, the handful that five or 10 that you find in the competing marketplaces for the same products. Okay, Amazon, more is better, right? More reviews is better, right? Should we be trusting these reviews? Well, there's an answer to that. No. No, we're not.
Evan.
Yes.
How widespread? So
the other day I went to buy something on Amazon, and I was looking at the reviews, mm-hmm, and after the first 5 or 6, I very quickly realized that they were for a different product.
Ah, yeah, whoa, that's one of the things.
So do they like sell good reviews off old products and then refill the skeleton in the back end?
Yeah, how about this, Kara? Here's what they do. You'll have a product that's been on there a long time, and for, mm-hmm, whatever reason, it's either discontinued or something like that. There are ways to go in there and actually either purchase, I don't know what it is, the rights to it or something,
yeah,
or something.
Oh,
and then
no,
you take, and then you're allowed to keep all those reviews and you can plaster that onto another product.
Yes, I know
what?
That's what these people,
yes,
did. It was insane.
How is that legal?
It shouldn't be, but this is one of the many loopholes and flaws and problems with the Amazon system. Now, Amazon claims, you know, that they do look out for cases like this and they do correct them when they get to it. But and that's sort of the overall point of all of this, is that for all the efforts that Amazon makes to correct it, and they do have pretty robust, you know, people and armies and machines and algorithms and everything to help weed it out, it by the time they get to it, on average, the damage has already been done. It cannot keep up with the short-term tsunami of this stuff that is occurring. It's just way, way too much, even for Amazon, one of the largest companies on the planet. But generally speaking, we should not be trusting these reviews as much as we do, but there's something psychological about it in which, and the whole Amazon experience sort of caters to it. Now, I was reading, and the reason I'm bringing this up is that CNBC ran a video article this past week, which showcased many issues and outright fraud involved in the entire Amazon rating and review scheme. For example, they uncovered Facebook groups where unscrupulous purveyors of questionable quality products pay people to leave positive reviews of their products. They incorporate bots, and they have foreign click farms that upvote negative reviews to take out the competition.
Yeah. Oh, that's messed up. Oh,
totally.
Oh,
that is so common, it's ridiculous.
Oh, it's so sad.
It is sad. And I imagine that all we've been, you know, at some point in our Amazon experiences, we've actually experienced this, but not realizing exactly what it is that's going on here. So here's a case in point, a few studies and some other research. There was a study released this past July. Researchers from UCLA and USC analyzed more than 20 fake review-related Facebook groups. These groups have an average of 16,000 members. That's average.
Whoa.
Each group would average 560 postings each day, in which the sellers of these products would offer refunds or payments, outright payments for positive reviews of these products, about $6 each. But hey, if you're in another, which is not, by U.S. standards, not necessarily
but
a
also,
lot.
How are they making any money if they're like, how much are the products they're selling?
Yeah, well, it comes back to quantity. How many can they get out the door in a very short amount of time before their scheme ultimately gets either discovered, shut down, or in some other way curtailed? But as long as they can keep it going, yeah, the quantity makes up for it. There is a British online consumer website called Which, WICH.co.uk. Recently, they did a quick study. They said in a matter of hours, they were able to uncover more than 10,000 reviews from unverified purchasers on 24 items. 24 items alone, 10,000 reviews from unverified purchasers. In fact, one pair of headphones being sold by an unknown brand had 439 reviews, all of them 5-star, all of them unverified, and all of them posted on the same day. 439 reviews. And as many as, same folks at Which, they're saying as many as 97% of shoppers rely on online reviews to help make their purchases.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's 97%. That's practically everybody.
I don't even read them. I rely upon like reviews from organizations, like that, where experts review the product.
Consumer. Not,
I only do that for expensive things. Right, I don't do that for cheap stuff.
Little stuff.
Well, but like, anything that I would bother researching, if anything that I care about. If I care about it, I'm not going to rely upon rando reviews on the website.
No, but the problem is you buy a lot of little things on Amazon, and when you grab like, oh, I need a new knife sharpener,
right?
You're like, I don't know, and then you go on Amazon and you're like, that one looks cheap and it's got Prime shipping, but so is this one. Which one's better? And then, oh, well, this one has 3,000 reviews and it's 96% positive. That's better.
Another study.
I guess not.
A separate study. This is U.S. Consumer Behavior by Northwestern University's Spiegel Research Center. Online reviews have the power Online reviews have the power to increase purchase rates as much as 380%. So you can obviously tell they are getting returns on these investments in these fake ways of boosting their ratings and their reviews. Oh my gosh. And I could go on, Steve. I mean, do you want me
to? So how does Amazon fix the problem though?
All right.
Or is
so
it not fixable?
Yeah. All right. So Amazon, let's see, let me read to you what their official statement is on this when CNBC asked them. Amazon told CNBC it uses powerful machine learning tools and skilled investigators to analyze over 10 million review submissions weekly, aiming to stop abusive reviews before they are ever published. They said we have clear policies for both reviewers and selling partners that prohibit abuse of our community features, and we suspend, ban, and take legal action against those who violate those policies. And that is all true. That has been verified, and they do it, and they continue to invest more money into it, especially now that their revenue is up so much because of COVID. I mean, their revenue streams have jumped amazingly in just the last few months. But also, I think I read it was about $4 billion that they used to shore up these systems and these people and the technology that they're using to find it out. But even still, even with all them putting, you know, dousing as much water on this fire as possible, on average, it takes about 30 days for the fakes to be discovered and taken down, which is too little too late. So they don't have enough. It's simply a matter of quantity. They said the scope is vast. How about this? 5 million sellers using Amazon and over 600 million products. It's just too much. You know, they would have to increase it, I don't know, tenfold maybe to try to get it down to a point where they could keep it up on a day-to-day basis.
Or they need AI to do it.
Yeah, I would think so. They're going to have to, maybe they should, maybe. And who knows if they're researching that or investigating that. But that's kind of the overview. That's where we are with Amazon. So caveat emptor, folks. I mean, please beware and do not rely solely on those Amazon reviews.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Thanks.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week, I played this noisy. Wow.
Jay, that's what the dentist did to my mouth today. That's exactly what it sounded like. Oh, I'm so sore right now. I had a cavity, drilled out and filled. And you can smell sort of the shaving or the carving out of the bone.
It's
weird. Has an odor to it that is unique, at least I think, to that experience, because I have experienced it before when I've had other cavities filled. And
it's a terrible feeling. It really is. I mean, could you imagine not having modern dentistry? Oh my God.
Gosh.
Don't get me started on that.
I'd rather be buried face down in a medieval grave.
Anyway, a listener named Daryl Giors wrote in and said, I think it's the sound aboard a maglev train speeding up. Isn't the correct answer, and I don't know what it sounds like, but I would imagine it must sound something like that, right? It's got to have some type of recognizable sound. I'll have to look into that and see what it is. But thank you, Daryl. It's not correct, but that was a cool guess. Another listener named Jody Lesko wrote in, Hi, Jay and crew. This week's noisy starts with something that sounds like burning or static, which then turns into an orchestral sound. I'm guessing it's pipes being heated until they vibrate, with pipe lengths varying in such a way that it creates a musical chord. Damn, you have an incredible imagination. That's not correct, but now I have to hear what that sounds like. Jody, make it happen. Next one, Michael Rops. He's been a listener for a very long time.
Yes.
Yeah, you recognize
him. Oh, that Michael Rops, yes.
He said, that's obviously the THX movie sound played on some bad speakers. So many, many people wrote in and said that that's what it was. Here is a quick shortened version that I have to show you what the THX audio experience sounds like.
I love that. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Not completely dissimilar. We have a winner last week. Eric Confer said, Hi, Jay and SG. Exclamation point. SG Skeptics Guide. Yeah, it's got to be Skeptics Guide, right? Not Supergroup or
Supergroup.
Sanctimonious Geezers or...
I like that one.
Yeah, I can keep going. He said, this week's sound is 1,000 oscillators being tuned together. I forget the YouTuber's name offhand, but I watch his work at times. Check out the Sega oscillator he makes sometimes. That is correct. So I will go back to the original person, Craig Good, who's a great friend of the show. Craig wrote in with this one. He said, this guy is nuts. What he built is nuts. It's the killer drone, 1,000 oscillators that can sweep into resolution. So this thing is also called the 1,000 Oscillator Megadrone. And what was funny was Craig actually said in his email to me that people might mistake this for the THX Deep Note, which is what I just played.
Right.
Because there is a very big similarity. And he said that the person who originally came up with that sound had it stolen from him and he didn't get credit for it. So that THX sound, there is some interesting backstory to it. Apparently it was stolen somehow. So from Wikipedia, let me tell you what an oscillator is in case you don't know. An electronic oscillator is an electronic circuit that produces a periodic oscillating electronic signal, often a sine wave or a square wave. Oscillators convert direct current DC from a power supply to an alternating current AC signal. They're widely used in many electronic devices, ranging from simple clock generators to digital instruments like calculators and complex computers and peripherals, etc. So this guy took 1,000 of them, lined them all up, wired them, and was able to control all of them at the same time. And they all came into a similar or exact oscillation, and that's where it kind of sounds like the whole thing is getting dialed in. Let me just play that moment of resolution there real quick so you can hear it again. I mean, there is something to be said about 1,000 things, 1,000 voices. You know, when you get that many things making a similar noise, there is something about the chorus of that repetition that has such, what would you call it, gravitas. I mean, it's just an incredibly powerful experience.
Resonance.
Yes, that's a great word for it. Craig, epic, epic, noisy. Thank you so much. It's one of my favorites. You got to watch the video. Look up the 1,000 Oscillator Megadrone and watch this guy completely geek out on this. It's so funny. He's like, when he's building it, he's like, I don't know what, why am I doing it? Like, holy Christ, I can't believe I'm doing this. No, he's like, just so like, semi blown away by the fact that he did it. Anyway, there is another noisy. There can be only one. There is a new noisy this week. It was sent in by a listener named Robert House. Here it is. So I want you to tell me what the deep sound is in that noisy. Because I know that there's some birds tweeting in the background, but that's not the primary sound. All right. So if you think you know what the noisy is this week or you heard something cool, you can always email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, I have one announcement.
Mm-hmm. Hit it.
So our friends over at Skepticon, which are the Australian skeptics, they are having an online conference this year, October 23rd to 25th. So their lineup includes people talking about medicine, space, reproducibility crisis, climate, human evolution, and science and skepticism. Sounds like an awesome conference. Without a doubt, Dr. Carl will be there. And I just heard from Polly, who is one of the organizers, and she said there's going to be a TGA panel. Eric Streed, who took the first photo of a shadow of an atom. Wow. Tanya Smith, who has won awards for her work on human evolution and Neanderthal teeth. They're also announcing a climate panel on Sunday with people from the Climate Council and 2020 QLD Tall Poppy winner. I don't know what the Tall Poppy winner is, but that sounds intriguing. So there it is. You guys can go to www.skepticon, that's skepticon.org.au, if you happen to be in that part of the world. I also think that Michael Marshall is going to be there. I saw him on the list, so he's going to be speaking as well. Should be
it's
a lot
online,
of fun.
It's online, right? So you
it's
don't
online.
Really have
that's
to
correct.
Be in that part of the world.
Yeah, you're right.
Everyone.
You're right. You don't
have to
be there.
Awake when that part of the world is awake.
You can be virtually anywhere, and you can watch
virtual.
This conference. Just like Nexus. You just do it. And it's good to do this, guys, because it shows your support for critical thinking. It helps us keep running these conferences. I know exactly how these guys feel. It's an amazing amount of work to pull it all together. So if you have the time, please do go over to skepticon.org.au and check it out.
All right, we're going to do one quick email. This comes from Paul Abram from Chilliwack. Chilliwack, British Columbia. You guys ever hear of Chilliwack?
That's a place?
Yes, I know Chilliwack. My friend Karen Bondar, who a lot of people listening might know, she's the she wrote, I think, Wild Sex. She's like a cool biologist who writes a lot about sex in the animal kingdom. She lives in Chilliwack.
Chilliwack. So anyway, he writes, as a longtime listener, I know that one of your favorite ongoing sagas are the ridiculous panspermia claims coming from Steele and Wick Ramasinghe in Australia. Well, they have done it again, this time with COVID-19. Then he gives us a link. He goes into the study, but I can't read his very, very long email. I'm just going to give you the highlights here. So this is an absurd article. The article is Origin of New Emergent Coronavirus and Candida Fungal Diseases, Terrestrial or Cosmic? So and I think
they lump together coronavirus with Candida.
Yeah, so Paul, I think, correctly observes that this article is probably originally about Candida, and they just tacked on coronavirus because it's like that's going to get them headlines and get them in the news.
Those two things have nothing to do with each other.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
But then what they did was, I mean, they obviously wrote the article with that in mind, though. So the idea is that these two infections, these two pandemics, came from space, right? That's like, how could a virus crop up out of nowhere and suddenly spread all around the world, you know?
Inconceivable.
It's inconceivable. Or how could Candida auris, you know, the specific species, come out of nowhere and then pop up in several different places of the world,
magic,
you know, at the same time? And we're not sure how it got from point A to point B. So, you know, the whole hypothesis is absurd on many levels. First of all, it's not a mystery where coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2, came from, nor how it spread. It's not a mystery at all. And same thing with Candida. This is, you know, a fungal infection. And they're trying to argue that because these new strains crop up, that the most plausible theory is that they fell from, you know, from cosmic sources, from panspermia. Fell from the sky, from space. Not that they...
No, they spill over from animals.
Not that they evolved. Yeah, I know.
Like, we already know that.
The other thing is, how could SARS-CoV-2 come from space when it's so closely related to SARS-CoV-1?
SARS-CoV-1 came from space too.
Yeah, whatever. So, do they think that all... I think they think that all viruses came from space. Yeah, so I mean, it's just absurd on its face. You know, they don't have any even reasonable argument. It's all just pure nonsense.
What's the angle? Are they just trying to be contrarians? I mean,
they're just promoting their pet theory of panspermia. You know, that life comes from space.
But it's literally like one of these, like, you know, it's like, and then a miracle happens. Like, yeah. Can't explain it.
Right.
Must have come from space.
But it's worse, right? Because we can't explain it. So it's a they're creating a fake mystery and then proposing an absurd solution to their non-mystery.
You know, maybe they're reading a little bit too much of like Scott Sigler's Infected series, because that's exactly what happens. This virus comes from space, but it's created specifically to infect people. So they don't even include that obvious thing that you would need to have a virus come from space.
Well, maybe they're building up to that, Bob. Stay tuned.
All right. That's enough about that. Guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. So as is typical when we record early, especially since yesterday was a holiday.
We've got a theme coming.
Yeah, we've got a theme. And we're recording a day early because Jay forgot that tomorrow is his daughter's birthday.
You're so mean.
Oh, how many times am I going to be accused of this? First of all, my daughter is born on 9/9. There's no way to forget that date. That's number one. Number two, I thought that we were going to be having a, you know, dinner and a quick birthday cake for my daughter, and then I would go upstairs and record the show as normal, right? Because it's in the middle of the week, you're not going to have a big party. And, you know, Sunday we're taking her horseback riding for her birthday. You know what I'm saying? That's the big day. But, of course, because my wife is such an unbelievable planner and unbelievable at that, okay, she has decided to have a party on Wednesday, tomorrow, and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being, yes, I was busy. I should have known, Steve, but I didn't.
It's like a birth week more than a birthday.
Kind of. Right. It's a big one.
Thanks for straightening that out. So you basically didn't confirm. Okay, so which means all of this means that I had to come up with a theme for this week's science fiction because there was not enough news items. The theme is quite completely randomly wolves. Wolfie.
Wolfie.
You guys know a lot about wolves?
Wolfgang.
Okay. Here we go. Three random facts about wolves. Item one. Wolves were completely eradicated from the British Isles by about 1760. Item number two. Wolves raised and socialized by humans from young pups are as tractable as domestic dogs. Tractable is in quotes. By tractable, scientists mean that they're as controllable, trainable. And item number three, in North America, there have been only 6 reported unprovoked wolf attacks against humans in the last century, none of which were fatal. All right, Jay, because you know,
I'm here. You're going to go first.
Go. You go first.
Wolves were completely eradicated from the British Isles by about 1760. So, I mean, what? There's no wolves over there? Or they were, maybe they were repopulated. I mean, that's a pretty serious claim right there. I got to think on that a little bit. Wolves raised and socialized by humans from young pups are as tractable as domestic dogs. And finally, in North America, there have been only 6 reported unprovoked wolf attacks against humans in the last century, none of which were fatal. Okay, I'm going to write out of the gate, I think the second one here, that wolves raised and socialized by humans from young pups. There is no way that they're even close to being as domestic as dogs. As long as I understand the definition of that word, I don't believe that they even come close to what a domesticated dog is. So that's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, to me, that one just leaps out and smacks me in the face. I'll say that's fiction, too.
All right, pretty confident. Evan?
Now, about wolves being completely eradicated from the British Isles in 1760, I have two things to say about that. Okay, so if that's the case, then there was the Pied Piper or something led all the wolves out of Britain or something along those lines. And secondly, that means the American Werewolf in London story is a fiction, and I have a hard time believing that. So, jumping to number three, the only 6 reported unprovoked wolf attacks against humans, that seems really low, awfully low number, especially for a vicious wolf. None of which fatal, but yeah, that one's probably true. That one leaves for the same reasons that Jay and Bob brought up, tractable as domestic dogs. Wouldn't we see more families with wolves in their households? And I don't know of many of those, and I think you would see a higher prominence of that if that were the case. So therefore, that's the fiction.
And Kara.
I think I agree with the British Isles one. I know there were wolves at some point, but it was a really long time ago. 6 reported unprovoked wolf attacks against humans in the last century, none of which were fatal. That one, I guess the unprovoked qualifier is what makes that one probably science. Like if somebody was kind of asking for it, then maybe a wolf attacked them because they were taunting it or something like that, or holding up food. Getting too close to their pups. Although that doesn't account for any rabies attacks, which is interesting. Or maybe they've only been non-fatal. I don't know. Also, there just aren't that many wolves. Like, I mean, certain regions, there are a lot of wolves, but they've kind of sadly been pushed out of a lot of more populated areas. Yeah, I think I have to agree with the guys that although you probably can get some kind of cuteness out of puppy wolves, as they get older, I bet you they are like hard to tame, and they are just, they don't listen to people as well, and they probably are like more aggressive than domestic dogs. So I bet you there are just certain things that we needed those thousands of years of evolution for that they just don't have readily. You can't do in one generation. So I'm going to say, I'm going to GWTGs.
Okay.
Go with the guys.
Yeah. Go with the guys. All right. Yeah. Well, we'll take these in order then. Number one, wolves were completely eradicated from the British Isles by about 1760. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is science. This one is science. Yay. So yeah, they were common in Great Britain, hence all of the fairy tales and stuff about them. But they were deliberately eradicated. You know, they were hunted down, wiped out. They were thought of as pests. They served no useful function. They were just, you know, predators. They would prey upon livestock, kill people. And so there were like multiple laws passed to hunt them down. There were, you know, bounties put on them, et cetera. And they were, yeah, hunted to extinction. Now, obviously, we're not 100% sure about the date, but that's the last known wolf kill in 1760. There were are unconfirmed reports of wolf sightings after that date, but they're unconfirmed, and who knows. So yeah, that's why I say about. I'm not sure if that's literally the last wolf anywhere, but that's the last confirmed wolf kill was in 1760. There haven't been any wild wolves in Great Britain since. Okay, let's go to number two. Wolves raised by and socialized by humans from young pups are as tractable as domestic dogs. You guys all think this one is the fiction. And by young pups, they mean like they have to be raised from before they can open their eyes. Mm-hmm. And they have to be intensely socialized by people. Mm-hmm. But even then, they don't get nearly as tractable as. Yeah, this is the fiction. Tractable. So they actually, but they're more tractable than you might think. I mean, they can sort of exist in a family, and they can be trained to be, you know, pretty controllable and tamed. Again, they're not domesticated, but they're tame.
We could be like outside dogs.
Yeah, but but when they but for example, if you play fetch with them, they're less likely to relinquish the item, you know, than a real dog.
Uh-huh.
They're more likely to get, you know, growly and defensive over any resource, right? Like if you get near their food, you know, they'll growl at you.
Sure.
They're more likely to get bitey when you brush them. So they can be pretty good, actually. I mean, you know, wolves and dogs are not that far apart, evolutionarily speaking. But yeah, the domestication did have a clear effect.
Yeah, what would be the advantage to having a wolf as opposed to a dog? I can't see one.
I don't know. I get maybe if you live in a region where, I don't know, historically, it might just happen with certain families who, like, maybe Inuit families or somebody who lives very far north.
Sure. But when you think about it, though, the fact that you can, like, hand raise a wolf and they could reasonably function in a human society shows you, like, how plausible that was early on. You know, before wolves were domesticated at all, they could have coexisted with humans, even in their wild state.
I learned something super cool when I interviewed this guy who wrote about the Russian fox experiment.
Yeah.
That, you know, dogs follow human fingers. Like, we can point, and a dog will look where we're pointing.
My dog does
awesome.
That, yes.
Yeah, dogs are amazing that they can do that. When the foxes, pre-domestication, couldn't do that. Like, no wild fox can do that. But post-domestication, they could. And I think there's some evidence that wolves, although they're really bad at it, there's some evidence that they have been able to do that, or at least to follow humans' gaze periodically. Mm. And so it's like they have these precursors that are almost necessary for domestication that are already there. It's like they're just one step closer than foxes, which require a lot more work in order to domesticate.
Right, right.
Which is why we probably have dogs are wolves. Dogs aren't foxes.
All right. All this means that in North America, there have been only 6 reported unprovoked wolf attacks against humans in the last century, none of which were fatal, is science. This isn't just because, you know, wolf populations are reduced in North America. There are, you know, wild wolf populations thriving in different locations in North America. Again, they were hunted here too, but we didn't wipe them out before... you know, more enlightened age switch them from being hunted to being protected. But the thing is that the concept of wolves as sort of vicious predators is not really accurate. That they generally tend to leave people alone. They don't go out of their way like to hunt down people. So there were only six cases, you know, where a wolf attacked a person. And none of those cases were fatal. There were, over the same period of time, 21 cases of wolves attacking humans, but they were provoked mainly by people feeding them. So they counted that as provoked. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you shouldn't try to feed a wild wolf, you know.
And that seems like pretty good advice.
Yeah, and only one of those cases was fatal. The rest were not fatal. But it's not clear... Actually, that's a controversial case because they basically just saw a wolf eating a person, and they didn't know if he was scavenging or if he had killed the person. They weren't able to definitively tell that the wolf killed him. So it's one possible fatality. The rest were non-fatal. Yeah, so, you know, also the all of the concerns about wolves, like they prey on livestock very little. It's insignificant compared to other losses, natural losses of livestock. So, like, there's no reason to eradicate wolves, you know, because you fear for your livestock. Obviously, you know, any farmer that loses an animal to a wolf is going to take it very seriously. But statistically speaking, it's like less than 1%, you know, of loss compared to 70 or 80% of the losses that occur being due to things like disease or injury or whatnot. So it really is insignificant. So, and they're actually, you know, they're generally speaking, you know, friendly, sociable animals. You know, they're not really the vicious killers that fairy tales portray them to be.
I mean, after all my reading throughout the years, you know, I never actually read a negative account about wolves, like where I was like, oh man, they're really dangerous. Like I've come to be not afraid of them. You know what I mean? Like, I've seen them a few times in my life. And if anything, I'm like, I think they're beautiful and they're really, you know, they're just really wonderful to look at and they're not intimidating.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I wonder how much of that is from European folklore, like influence from European encounters, because I feel like the American experience of the wolf is much more influenced by like Native American mythology and wolves being these really majestic creatures.
Yeah, possibly. Here's the question. How many half wolf, half dog animals do you think are pets in North America?
Right. 4 for 1.
Probably illegally, but
no, some quantity.
Yeah, how many?
5,000.
100,000.
100,000.
100,000 half wolf, you know, pets.
Wow.
And they're fun. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Busy.
Yeah, because it's the same species. Yeah. It's just a different like subspecies, I guess. Yeah, basically. Or whatever they call it.
Yeah, I actually really love wolves. I think they're gorgeous animals. Never. I don't think I've ever seen one in the wild.
I haven't either.
Seen a black bear in the wild.
Is your back last night wild?
I see coyotes all the
coyotes
time.
I've seen coyotes, I've seen foxes. Yeah. Bob, you've seen a bobcat, right?
Yeah, twice.
In fact, you're named
That's
after
cool.
one.
I saw a mountain lion. Yeah,
you did. You saw a wild mountain lion?
Yep.
I go to
Colorado quite a bit.
Oh, we've seen them like driving in Florida. You'll see
they can drive.
No, I mean, while we're driving like on the road, you'll see them, you know, on the side of the road or whatever.
That's cool. I've never seen one here in LA. I mean, we have a lot, but I've never seen one.
Do you ever see a moose? They're huge and they will kill you.
Do you know what I saw in Africa a ton of are jackals? And I don't know if you guys remember, but prior to us talking about the jackal on this show, I had no idea what one was.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
That's funny. Yeah.
Remember, that was one of those weird gaps in my knowledge.
Yeah.
And then I
never saw the omen?
No, I guess not.
You never saw the jackal?
No, didn't see that either.
Okay. I guess not.
The Antichrist apparently will be born of a jackal.
Oh, I love jackals.
Yeah. Why are they pairing up jackals with Antichrist?
I know.
Because they have this weird cackly howl at night, which I think is beautiful, but it sounds pretty evil.
Yeah.
I've heard more evil. I've been married to more evil.
Are we going there?
Jeez.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right. I don't believe in astrology. I'm a Sagittarius, and we're skeptical. That quote is attributed to Arthur C. Clarke. All right. So, you know, when I saw this quote, first of all, I checked to see if we had used it before. We hadn't. Then I was reading it. Okay, and I'm checking it out on websites and stuff, making sure it's okay. I'm like, you know, because this is the kind of thing that anybody could have said. And, you know, okay, throw Arthur C. Clarke's name on it. So I came across a website called Quote Investigator. This is a handy website. They trace quotes. They do the legwork, basically, for everyone. Was this quote really attributed correctly? In this case, it appears yes, to the best of their knowledge, yes. They hunted it down from an April 1997 issue of the UK magazine Astronomy Now. There was a letter from a reader who basically said, talked about an interaction he had with Arthur C. Clarke. He said, this is a point that all of us would do well to bear in mind, as perhaps it is that made by Arthur Clarke when he told me, I don't believe in astrology, I'm a Sagittarian, and we're skeptical. Which apparently is a take on a phrase that has been bantered about since kind of like the 1970s. There are earlier other versions of that quote said by other people. For example, in March of 1978, they said they have a guy, who is it? In a comic strip. There was a comic strip called Frank and Ernest. And in that comic strip, one of the characters says, I don't believe in astrology. We are Scorpios. We're too scientific for that sort of thing. So they went into the research to find all the iterations of this, but the actual Arthur C. Clarke statement appears legitimate to have come from that source. So that was fun.
But I've heard many, many people steal that, including myself. I've stolen it.
There you go. Sure, why not?
It's kind of obvious. It's funny.
But are you a Sagittarius?
No, I'm a Leo. So I say, if somebody says anything about astrology, I go, yeah, I'm a Leo, and Leos don't believe in astrology.
Right. It works with anything.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, man.
See you on Friday.
Yep. We'll see you all on the Friday live stream. Yay. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.